Okay, so picture this. It's 1978 in Bryan, Texas, and we have this brutal carjacking.
Yeah.
This guy, Timothy Murka, he's just trying to be a good Samaritan, right? And he ends up beaten to death with a jack. They rob him too. It's just a horrible crime. And that leads to, well, this is where Danny Ray Harris enters the picture. He gets convicted, gets the death sentence.
Right. A really tough case, for sure. But you didn't bring this to us just to rehash the details of that night or even to debate whether Harris actually did it.
No, not at all. What we're really going to dig into today is something way bigger, something that's relevant to literally every single criminal conviction out there, is the whole world of appeals, appellate review here in Texas. And that gets, well, it can get pretty messy.
Well, absolutely.
We're going to be looking at the idea of harmless error, which is kind of a loaded term,
Okay.
right? And then, how courts try to balance making sure trials are fair, but also like drawing a line and saying, okay, this is final, this is the end.
Yeah. Finality, that's the term they use.
Exactly. And that gets extra tricky when you're talking about capital punishment, when someone's life is literally on the line. What we have here with this case, it's almost like we get this behind the scenes look at how Texas courts handle appeals, even when, there were some pretty serious procedural problems at the trial.
Yeah, and that's what always makes these cases so fascinating, right?
Absolutely. Because I was reading through all this and it just hits you. You have these rules meant to protect the rights of someone accused of a crime, right? That's crucial.
Fundamental.
But then you have this pressure to uphold a conviction when the evidence seems like, slam dunk.
And everyone's thinking, well, he's obviously guilty.
Right. So then it immediately raises the question, where do you draw that line? When do you say, okay, something went wrong here. We need to do this again?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And honestly, the way this case went through the court system,
Yeah.
it's not a straight line at all. You have twists, you have turns.
So let's start at the beginning, lay it out for everyone. So Harris gets convicted of capital murder, death penalty. You'd think, end of story, right? Sad, but it's over. But, well, better than anyone. It rarely ends there.
Almost never, especially with a case like this. The first appeal, well, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, they actually overturned it.
Really? Wow. What was the
The
reason?
defense lawyers, they weren't allowed to properly cross-examine one of the main witnesses, Valerie Rentschler.
Oh, cross-examination, that's huge. That's like,
A core part of a fair trial. To confront the witnesses against you, challenge their testimony.
Yeah.
You can't just skip that.
Right. So that first conviction gets tossed out, and what? They just redo the whole trial?
Yep, back down to the lower court for a retrial. And get this, Harris is convicted again. Same charge, death penalty again. Now you'd really think, okay, this is it.
Twice. Yeah,
But,
really.
well, the second appeal, that's where things get really strange.
Okay, now I'm intrigued.
So the court reporter's note from a pretrial hearing, they just disappear, vanished.
You're kidding. In a death penalty case, how does that even happen?
It's a huge mess up, no question.
Yeah.
And this is where we have to talk about Dunn v. State. This legal precedent, it's crucial to understanding what happens next.
Dunn v. State. Okay, give us the breakdown.
Basically, the Dunn rule, it says that if part of the trial record goes missing and it's not the defendant's fault, then they usually get a new trial. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, how can an appeals court do its job if they don't have all the pieces?
Exactly. You can't properly review a case for errors if you're missing chunks of what happened at the trial. Now, there's an exception. If both sides agree to use a substitute for the missing info, but that's not what happened here.
Right, the notes are gone, not Harris's fault, and no agreement on a replacement. Seems like a pretty straightforward Dunn situation, right? Back to trial number three.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But during Harris's second appeal, the trial court tries to get around this. They come up with a document that's supposed to summarize what happened at that missing pretrial hearing. And now you have this split, this real division within the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. They can't agree on how strictly they should apply the Dunn rule in this case.
So some judges are like, rules are rules, and others are more like, well, let's be practical here.
That's a good way to put it. The majority of the court, they said, we've got this substitute, it's good enough. They upheld the conviction.
Even with a missing piece of the puzzle, what was their logic there?
Well, the main opinion, written by Judge Duncan, he argued that what they had was enough for the appeal. They could still review the case.
Okay, but it feels like they're, I don't know, maybe implying that because they had so much other evidence against Harris, it didn't really matter that something was missing. Like, he's guilty anyway, so let's not get bogged down in technicalities.
That's the vibe I got too, reading between the lines. But not everyone on the court agreed. Justice Teague, He really went after this.
I was wondering when we'd get to the dissent. He's not known for holding back, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Yes. Just as Teague wrote this blistering dissent, it's all about the importance of sticking to the rules, the procedures. He even said, and this is a direct quote, "There is only one way to get around Dunn, and that is to expressly overrule it."
Strong words.
His argument is basically this. The court's creating an exception out of thin air, and that's dangerous. It sets a bad precedent. To Teague, this wasn't just about Danny Ray Harris. It was about the whole legal system. He was worried that if you start letting courts do this, it's like saying, well, sloppiness is okay as long as we think the right guy got convicted.
And that erodes trust in the system, right?
For sure.
So we've got the missing notes, this whole debate about the Dunn rule, but there's more, isn't there? They brought up some other stuff about Harris during the second trial, right?
Right. The jury, they heard about two previous robberies that Harris had been convicted of. And even the majority on the appeals court, they admitted this was a mistake.
Wait, so they admit it's an error, but then they just keep going. How does that work?
They called it harmless error. It's another one of those legal concepts that trips people up.
So what? It's like saying, yeah, we messed up, but it doesn't matter.
It's not quite that simple. Harmless error means that the appeals court looked at everything and decided, okay, we're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that this mistake didn't affect the conviction or the sentence.
How can they really know that, especially in a death penalty case? I mean, come on, how can they be so sure?
And that's Justice Clinton's whole point in his dissent. He was furious about this. He wrote, "The errors cannot be considered harmless if they serve to influence the jury." And I think he's right.
So Justice Clinton's saying it's not enough to just say, well, we probably would have convicted him anyway. You have to look at whether the mistake itself might have swayed the jury.
Right. He's focused on how that error could have influenced their thinking, especially when they're deciding, okay, was this murder deliberate? Because in Texas, that's the difference between life in prison and execution.
So Justice Clinton's basically asking, how can we possibly know that hearing about those past robberies didn't make the jury more likely to think, yep, this guy's a career criminal, he definitely did it on purpose, or maybe even he deserves the death penalty because of his past?
He's hitting on this really important question. What's the psychological impact of that kind of information on a jury? Can you really say with absolute certainty that it didn't play a role in their decision, especially a decision this huge?
No, I don't think you can. And then we have presiding Judge McCormick. He agrees with the majority, votes to uphold the conviction, but he's not exactly thrilled about it, is he?
Yeah, his concurring opinion is interesting. He basically says, look, maybe the end result here, the conviction, maybe it is the right outcome. But the way the majority got there, that's a problem. He criticizes their whole approach, their reasoning. His point is that you can't just focus on whether the result seems fair. You have to be just as worried about following the rules, the process.
Right, because if it looks like courts are cutting corners or ignoring their own rules, even if it's for a good reason, people lose faith in the whole system.
Exactly. It's about more than just this one case.
Yeah.
So to everyone listening, think about this, the Harris case. It's a perfect example of how Texas handles these capital murder appeals. And you see this tension everywhere, this pull between wanting to be efficient to get a final answer, but also needing to be incredibly careful and protect the rights of the accused, especially when we're talking about the death penalty.
And we're seeing that even within the court itself, there's disagreement about how to balance those things.
Big time. I mean, we have these very strong dissenting opinions, right? That shows you that even among these top judges, they don't always agree on how to interpret these fundamental legal ideas like the Dunn rule or harmless error. These aren't easy questions.
This case, it really forces you to remember that having a lot of evidence that points towards guilt, well, that's not the same as making sure the trial itself was fair. No bias, no major errors that could have influenced the jury. It's a crucial distinction.
Absolutely. You have judges like Teague and Clinton. They're more like, look, we have these rules for a reason. We have to follow them, period. And then you have the majority who seem more willing to say, well, the evidence is strong enough, so maybe those mistakes don't really matter.
And then the McCormick trying to find that middle ground, you know, concerned about the process, even if the end result seems okay.
Three very different perspectives.
So we've started with this awful crime, moved through the convictions, and then really dug into the weeds of how appeals work in Texas, especially those two big issues, the lost records and those errors in the trial. It all comes back to this one question. How do you balance the need for a fair trial with the desire for a final resolution?
A tough question.
Yeah.
And it gets even harder when you're dealing with capital punishment.
Absolutely. So to wrap things up, let's put it back to our listeners. We've heard these powerful dissenting opinions, these warnings about what happens when we start bending the rules, even for a seemingly good reason. So what do you think? When an appeals court sees a possible error in a trial, but they're also looking at what seems like strong evidence of guilt, what should they prioritize? How much weight should they give to procedure, to making sure everything was done by the book? Because at some point, yeah, we want to punish the guilty, but if you're so focused on getting the right result, you might end up hurting the system as a whole. People need to trust that the system is fair, that the rules matter. And that's something to think about, something we all have to grapple with.
I agree. There's no easy answer here.
Not at all.